we'll get started. My name is Tom Witt, and I'm not sure, I didn't make announcements this morning, so I'm not sure what the title of the session is. Is it Praying for Peace, Paying for War? Okay, you're at the right session. All right. Just one thing to make clear from the beginning, this is not a session on tax evasion and how to get out of paying taxes. Some people find that confusing and come looking for something that I'm not going to be talking about. But it's specifically a session on war tax resistance and war tax refusal because of many people's firm belief in the immorality of war and of the taxes levied to support war and war preparation. So first, is there anyone here that works for the Internal Revenue Service? that has happened before, that we have had someone here from the IRS, and in fact it ended up being very helpful as a resource. So.
Well, I'm a tax attorney, so I'm a CPA, so.
Okay, maybe you can help as well. There are many different reasons for people doing tax resistance. As I mentioned just a little while ago, there are some people that are tax resistors because they're actually tax evaders. They want to get out of paying taxes. That's not what we're going to be talking about today. But there are also many different kinds of war tax resistors, and we need to talk about that a little bit. Some people resist paying taxes because they feel that that's a very rational stance to take. Some are simply humanists who believe that it's inhumane to pay for something that kills, and that war will cease only when we cease paying for it. There are others who are war tax resistors who are what we would call nuclear pacifists, in other words, those people who aren't opposed to every kind of war, or at least not up until the time that nuclear war became a possibility and now a probability, but now feel that because of new weapons of mass destruction, there can never be another justifiable war. And therefore, they are pacifists now, or modern war pacifists. There are anarchists who are war tax resistors, in other words, people who feel that the government will never deal with our money justly, so we ought not to give them any money, so they are war tax resistors as a result of that opinion. There are some people for whom tax resistance is a very un-American thing to do. For others, tax resistance gets at the very roots of patriotism, so they feel it is an American thing to do, a patriotic thing to do. Tax resistance is also a stand that more and more Christians are taking precisely because they feel payment of taxes to be a faith issue. So you can come at it from many different angles, and I think because we are here in Christian community, I'd like to talk about it primarily as a faith issue. That's where I'm coming from. So I hope that we're not disappointed in the fact that we won't get to all of it today. There's much to talk about. And I usually title this an introduction to war tax resistance. Not to convince anyone to be a war tax resistor, but to simply explain why more and more people are choosing this as a method of resisting the arms race, and particularly the nuclear arms race. I hope you're comfortable with not finishing or ending on a semicolon, as is so often the case here at Holden. I've given this session in 2 hours before, so I'm gonna pack it into 1 hour and try to leave some time for some questions. Another thing to know today, that I'm going to be starting with an assumption that I want to make clear from the very beginning, that the Bible has lots to say about opposition to violence and advocates other ways of dealing with our enemies, both on a personal level and on a corporate level. And I'm making this assumption clear from the very beginning that we as Christians need to be saying no to the arms race in some way. That all of us in some way need to be saying no to the arms race. And I'm saying it not because we are agreed on that, or that there isn't more to say on that, but because I want to focus in specifically on that very particular issue of our own personal connection to war through our tax dollars. And perhaps if there are questions about my assumption, maybe we can schedule another time this weekend or at the beginning of the week to talk about whether or not we should be opposing the arms race. But if you can bear with me for this hour, I'm going to be starting with that assumption that we need to be opposing the arms race in some way, if not out of a New Testament love for our enemies, at least for the sake of our children. I want to focus on tax resistance too, because I think it's becoming an increasingly publicized area and a method of resistance. If you're a Washingtonian, you probably have heard of tax resistance through the witness of Archbishop Hunthausen, Roman Catholic Archbishop from Seattle, who a couple of years ago, I think it was at an LCA Senate convention, suggested that a sizable number of people in this state undertake a taxpayers' revolt to protest the buildup in arms, and has more recently announced that he himself has withheld 50% of his taxes from the IRS, and I believe, again, is doing that this year. So it is in the news. More and more people are choosing this form of resistance, so I think we need to talk a little bit about why people are doing that. I've set some Bibles out here. We're going to take just a very brief look at what the Bible has to say about taxes, but I'm not going to do a lot of that just because the time factor. But I think before we talk about the Bible, it's important to know a little bit about taxes in this country, because income tax has not been around forever. There have been taxes since the beginning of this country, but not always income tax. Tax resistance, by the way, has very deep roots in this country. In fact, it predates the Constitution. Mostly taken on by people who are members of the historic peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, the Church of the Brethren. Never in really large numbers, but there were tax resistors during the colonial days, during the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and on, not in large numbers until World War II, and then more significant numbers during the Vietnam War. Part of this is due to the fact that income tax was such a minor part of the federal budget for such a long time. I didn't realize this before, but up until the 40s, federal income tax was only about 3% of the population was paying federal income tax for a long, long time, until 1940s and World War II, when it just shot up, largely because of the war. But the important point is that federal income tax was imposed as a direct result of war in 1862 because of the Civil War, then it was repealed and started again later. Federal income tax was started as a direct result of war, and since then has been the main financial source for war and war preparation. And I think that we first of all need to make that connection in our minds, that there's a very direct link between the taxes that we pay and the wars that we are either involved in or preparing for. And sometimes I have some charts, if you want to take a look at our history and the tax levels in this country as they have risen and fallen, and the wars that we have been involved in, and that could be a whole other session to talk about the role inflation and taxes and wars and war preparation. But just suffice to say that there is a very direct relationship between taxes and war. Tax figures now continue to change along with each new budget approval, so I will give the latest statistics that I have just from the beginning, just to say that these are very hard to figure out. There are different groups figuring them out. I've tried to take the one that I trusted the most, and we can have some discussion about them if you'd like, and I'm open to anybody that has any newer information than I do or any different information. But on the board, here is the budget pie. Total military spending adding up to 63% of our tax dollar. Now let me make an explanation here right from the beginning. You probably have seen figures that say that military spending is somewhere around 25 to 28%. I have seen those figures myself in a similar pie that had military spending at 28%. That takes a little bit of explanation, and I hope I don't confuse it. You'll have to let me know if I'm confusing you. The federal government gets money from several sources. The largest source, of course, is income tax. Government also gets money for non-military related programs through trust funds. Social Security being the largest of those. There's also a highway trust fund, an airline trust fund, a railroad trust fund. Are there others that I'm forgetting? Those are, I think, are the main ones. for a long time, those were considered by the government as sort of separate cookie jars, if you will. They were figured separately into two different funds and listed separately. But in the mid-1960s, during the Johnson administration, when our government was spending lots of money in the Vietnam War, the realization that perhaps this percentage of what we were spending on military was a little bit too high. So there was a device thought up called the Unified Budget, which was created in the mid-1960s by the Johnson administration to downplay the amount of money spent for the military and to make social spending look larger. And what happened is it's a unified budget. They combined those two, trust funds and income tax, into one budget pie. So now whenever the government prints this pie, this is what you see. Is not this one, but what you would see is trust funds included into, along with, income tax. So it tends to make it look like we are spending more money on social programs and less money on military, but in fact, we have added in trust funds, which are raised, money raised from a different source and always used for the specific non-military purpose that it was originally designated for. Let me just read to you a short paragraph from an article to show you how these statistics can be misused and deceiving. It's an article that I found, I think it was last year or the year before, in the Lutheran magazine, the LCA National magazine, and it's called A Strong Strategy for Peace, written by a gentleman who's been in the news a bit lately, Edwin Meese III, who is a Lutheran from Virginia. And he's talking about how it's a well-known fact that in the last decade, the United States has decreased its real military spending. At the same time, now we're in a danger because the balance has shifted and the Soviets now are way ahead. And I'll just read out of one paragraph. Mr. Meese says, in the early 1960s, 46 to 48% of our national budget was devoted to defense or national security purposes, and 26% was devoted to social purposes. Today, that is just reversed. Some 48% is devoted to social needs, with 26 or 27% devoted to national defense. And then, while the United States was changing its pattern, the Soviet response was to increase its military spending. I find this very disconcerting because what he does not tell you is that in between those two times in the mid-60s, they just started figuring the figures a little bit differently. And what he has done is juggle the figures so as to make it look like we're spending less now on military, which is not true. So it's a deceiving use of statistics. The accounting and the rhetoric has changed, but really not the reality. Military spending percentages are figured differently now. So what I have on the board here is a federal budget excluding trust funds. So this would be
interesting. Are you sure he didn't combine those figures at the beginning? That you were not
no, because he said budget? In the early 60s, 46
to 40. Are you sure you didn't use a unified budget in this calculation?
Well, if one looks, I went back and looked at what we were spending, and if you look at what we were spending before the unified budget was created, it was much less than that on national defense.
Yeah, during the early 60s. That's the truth.
Yeah. No, I went back and checked. It was in, I think, 64. Four or five that the change came, and I look back at the figures.
I don't argue that. I'm just making sure that you are sure that he didn't combine and use the same basis, because I would think that gentleman publishing in Lutheran would have to be pretty careful.
Well, I don't think he's. Maybe he was not aware of the fact that the accounting was changed, and I don't want to imply that he was deliberately trying to deceive people or that the Lutheran
wouldn't
was.
Have known it. Well, I mean, I would say he's either lying, or else he's that.
No, I did go back and check that.
Well, I would be a little bit careful about that one.
Tom, it is true, isn't it, that in total spending, Social Security has grown over the last 20 years faster than total military spending.
I think that's true.
Correct.
Yeah. What I have on the board excludes that part, so I don't have as good a grasp on that.
You're pulling out the
Social Security and trust funds.
I understand.
And what I have now is more... it's an more accurate description of what we pay with our income tax dollar.
Well, I dispute that too, because if you look at most countries in the world, they use a unified budget. You talk about Sweden, which hasn't had a war for years and years and years, mm-hmm. and you'll find that their unified budget is It's way skewed in terms of social resources. So.
Well, I'm not arguing against a unified budget. I'm just arguing about the deceiving use of statistics that.
Well,
that,
I'm arguing about maybe you're deceiving. This is my problem.
Well, this what I would say is that this would be a more accurate, and let me see if you agree with this. This is a more accurate description of what we're paying with our income tax dollar.
Not necessarily, because I don't think there's any real diversion. I mean, we talk about paying Social Security. It couldn't come out of our income tax dollars or out of our Social Security. We had to use some of these monies back and forth. Okay. And I think it's a total tax picture you have to look at. I mean, that's why I just have a problem. But go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, we can talk. We keep talking about that later. But
even as a percentage of the total, military spending is big enough.
Yeah. I have no objection with that. I agree.
Real huge.
Let me just break these on for those of you who can't see them. 63 for total military. Now that would include 43% for current military expenditures, 20% for past military. Now that would include 4% for veterans benefits and 16%, which they figure is the percentage of the interest on the national, the interest on past wars. Part of our national debt, probably 75% of our national debt is due to past wars. On the other side, 7% for physical resources, 20% for human resources, and 10% for general government, which is sort of a miscellaneous category. Totaled up, that comes out to be $431 billion, or roughly now $1,834 per person per year. Not, that would not be per taxpayer, but I just divided that by the number of people who live in our country right now. So you would have to figure out where you would.
Is there a nurse or a doctor? I need an answer.
And now the budget projections now for 86 and 87 go beyond this up to 65-66% of our tax dollar. But the point here being is that, you know, we can't tell everything from a budget by, and I agree that you can be deceiving with this, but I think a budget reflects priorities and priorities reflect values. And I really think that by looking at this, one gets the impression that what we were about is building bonds and preparing for war. We would have to be honest is to look at the whole tax picture, and we also would have to add in what we're paying for Social Security and those kinds of things. But I think it's a dangerous trend that this keeps growing and growing and seems to be out of control. Another way to look at it is many of us probably in the Lutheran Church or other churches may pay 3 to 4 times as much for military spending as we do to contribute to our churches and building up our church body. Another way to get at it, this is a couple of years old, so you'd have to extrapolate this a little bit, but by diverting approximately 5% of our defense, the military budget, we could achieve in the world eradication of protein malnutrition in children, food production to prevent famine, primary school for all children, create an international disaster relief force, achieve literacy for all adults, eradicate malaria, prevent anemia, prevent vitamin A deficiency blindness. All of this could be done throughout the world with just 5% of that budget. So the overkill from bombs is not the only kind of overkill that we're buying with those income tax dollars. Any questions at this point about this general pie and the current income tax situation? I think another, if I can add another way in which this strikes me, is it points out to me the drastic change in the nature of warfare during the last 50 to 100 years. As long as huge armies were necessary to wage wars, then if you did not believe in killing, or if you thought that was immoral, then an appropriate response might be conscientious objection. Or in other words, withholding your personal services from the government and saying, I will not go and personally do the killing. But now when it becomes possible through lots of automated warfare to kill and destroy with unmanned aircraft, with ICBMs, Tridents, minimal personnel, and lots of high technology, then I think the witness of withholding one's economic support becomes all the more important. And this is especially true for those of us men who are no longer draft age. I think that's how I became involved in tax resistance, when I had just passed the draft age and I was in between, in that in-between age where I didn't have to register for the Vietnam War, and I was before the group that has to register now. But I came to the realization after I was beyond that age, after I had kind of gone, I don't have to serve at least, then I started thinking of ways that I'm still connected to war, especially through the taxes that I pay. And that made me think that we're all connected, not only men who are of draft age, but men who are older, women, senior citizens. We are all connected to war through the taxes that we pay. So I really think that today warfare demands less of our person and more of our pocketbook. So that if we're concerned about war today, we ought to be concerned about the taxes that we pay. And that's really the primary point of this whole session. I want to take just a very brief look at what the Bible has to say about taxes. So if any of you who have access to Bibles want to get one, we're going to take a look at maybe just one passage right now. And I know there's a danger in doing this and sounding like we're proof texting, but I would like to look at one passage that has been used to say that we should always pay our taxes at all times. But I think in looking at the Bible, what we'd have to do is really to avoid two extremes, which neither of which I think hold up in Scripture. The one extreme would be to claim that the Bible commands us to pay our taxes in all situations, under any circumstances. And I think that will be one of the biggest hurdles for us to overcome, is that the Bible speaks very clearly with one voice about this. I don't think that there's that kind of absolutist position in the Bible. It does not command us to pay all of our taxes all the time. But we also need to avoid the other extreme, the non-payment of taxes. It's difficult to find biblical support for the anarchist position that we should try to avoid paying taxes. There are just too many biblical guidelines that point to God's creation of the powers and the necessity for Christians to be subject to the common good. So I think there is biblical support for the payment of taxes, but the question here is the payment of war taxes. And it's important to keep that context in reference to the biblical message, and then also that context in reference to the tax situation of that day out of which we're reading now. And I want to share a few paragraphs that maybe will set the scene before we look at any particular passage. This is an article called The Bible on Tax Resistance, written by Dale Brown a couple of years ago. And I'll just read a few paragraphs. Under Herod the Great, 37 to 4 BC, the tax burden had become unbearable. Though first approving the rebuilding of the temple, the Jewish people reached the point of resistance to a luxurious court and a building program out of proportion to the national wealth. There was a land tax, a poll tax, personal property taxes, export and import customs on salt and numerous items. The burden was intensified by the fact that there were two complete systems of taxation. In addition to the tribute due to foreign rulers, there was an annual half-shekel payment to the temple. It is estimated that the total taxation at the time of Jesus, both civil and religious, totaled from 30 to 40% of the total income. It is not surprising, then, that the scribes and Pharisees spoke of tax collectors and sinners in the same breath. Have to pay attention to our lesson tomorrow night at the Eucharist about that. The Jews of Palestine felt free from obligations to pay the tribute. Payment was often regarded as an acknowledgement of Caesar as Lord. Since the form of idolatry most repugnant to Jews was emperor worship, his image was detested. How do the gospel writers, then, place Jesus in this context? In answer to the query about his eating and drinking with tax collectors, Jesus neither approved what they were doing nor rejected them as persons. Instead, he affirmed that he had come to call sinners to repentance. Since some biblical scholars find evidence that as many as half of the special 12 disciples chosen by Jesus were from the extremist or the zealot party, it It's maintained that Jesus neither identified with, that it is maintained that Jesus identified with many of their sentiments concerning the righteousness and justice of the coming kingdom, but at the same time he could not identify with their deep hatred and violent plans. We do not possess certain evidence that Jesus was or was not an active teacher of tax resistance. If he was, it is fairly certain that he was a different kind of tax resister than his zealot associates. This broader context should be kept in mind as we examine the specific passages which are appropriated as proof texts for this issue. I'd like to just take a look right now at one passage, Matthew 22, verses 15 to 22. Matthew 22, 15 to 22. It's also in Mark and in Luke, but we'll read Matthew. Go ahead and read it.
Then the Pharisees went and took counsel how to entangle him in his talk. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully and care for no man, for you do not regard the position of men. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Jesus, aware of their malice, said, Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the money for the tax. And they brought him a coin. And Jesus said to them, Whose likeness and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away.
It's an interesting situation here because there are two normally antagonistic parties, the Pharisees and the Herodians, who are usually at each other's throats, but joining forces this time to try to entangle Jesus, to try to trap him, try to make him indict himself by committing himself on one side or the other. It's sort of a no-win situation. In other words, if Jesus would have said, yes, pay the taxes, he would have been in trouble with the people. If he would have said, no, don't pay the taxes, he would have been in trouble with the authorities. But in his answer, he calls for a coin. And what most people would have had in their pocket at that time would have been a tyrant shekel, which was the common currency in Palestine then. But what was pulled out, and if you have an RSV, I think there's usually an asterisk or something that refers down to the bottom of the page, what is pulled out is a Greek coin, a denarius, which has on the one side an image of Caesar, and if you remember, images at that time were very offensive to Jewish people, and on the bottom or on the back it had an inscription claiming the divinity of Caesar on the coin. Most Palestinian Jews would never have laid their hands on a denarius. So the fact that those people had, or at least one person, had the money of the oppressor in their pocket, which was manufactured on the other side of the Mediterranean, was evidence of their already being implicated or closely associated with or being of the government of Caesar. Again, the mindset of the Jewish people, they would have had an immediate reaction of feelings about tax collectors and the like. But some scholars go so far as to say that what Jesus was saying was, listen, you've already aligned yourself, or you've obviously chosen already who you serve, so give to your Lord and God what belongs to your Lord and God, but give to Yahweh what belongs to Yahweh. But in the end, if you notice, there's no absolute conclusion as to what to do. It's thrown back onto the Pharisees and the Herodians in the form of a question to us also. We have to decide to choose between faithfulness and allegiance and what that means. There's no clear-cut answer in the story as to who's being faithful and who's being unfaithful. I think that we would do well to try to answer that question for ourselves and to try to think it through rather than viewing it as a proof text. It's not mainly a story about the payment of taxes, but it's mainly a story about two parties trying to entrap Jesus. The fact that they used the question of taxes means that it already was an issue of the day. The payment of taxes was a faith issue, and we have to ask, to what extent is it a faith issue for us today, especially now when we have to pay war taxes? I don't believe at that time that there was a war tax. Are there any responses to that? I have some more follow-up on that, but go ahead.
I was thinking of your interpretation of this, rendered to Caesar what is Caesar's. audit to God, but as God. If you carry that to its logical conclusion, that then almost would indicate that payment of taxes is idolatry.
Your response to that?
You are choosing which God you are paying.
Mm-hmm.
That's contrary to our heritage.
Just open to responses. We could open up the discussion at this point.
It seems to me what we're talking about is rather, perhaps not an entirely special situation, but a more extreme situation of direct oppression of the faithful by the government. We might now feel that we're in a similar situation with the government forces us against our will to support the wars.
It's here when we get into the two extremes. You know, I am not ready. I mean, there are lots of places in the New Testament where it speaks the need for Christians to be subject to the common good. On the other hand, it talks about payment of taxes to whom taxes due, tribute to whom tribute is due. And I think it may be our duty to try to discern when that is due and when that is not due.
That's our traditional position. But to attribute to Jesus this choice between, you know, you made the comment, you have chosen which God, give to your God, or, mm-hmm. you know, or give to Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts it almost into an imperative type of situation where I choose between God and God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I'm right, ready to buy that. So.
Anybody else?
Someplace, I read this and heard this, and I can't remember where. But somebody said that there's Jesus' humor in this. That there was some question, and this is the part I can't remember. There was some question about the value of that coin because of inflation or something like that. That it was almost a worthless coin because of the inflation at that time. So what Jesus is saying is, here, give to Caesar what is due Caesar. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That which is inflated.
The other irony in that is that Caesar's likeness was on their coin and it was his. And on our coins it says, in God we trust, and we use that money to buy munitions to kill people.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to get away from in pointing out some of the things that I have is to try to lead us away from appropriating this text as a proof text that says we must pay our taxes in all situations, that Jesus was making a statement for all time. If I can just explain what I think that is helpful about this passage is that it puts the things that are God's and the things that are Caesar's into some sort of tension for us, and I think that's a very helpful story for us, because I think a lot of our problem has been in the thinking that God's things are the things that are sort of up there, that are the quote spiritual things. But Jesus' answer points to some demands of God that might overlap with, that might compete with, or even conflict with Caesar's demands. And it's especially hard for us to see in a democracy today how there could be such a conflict. Because in a democracy, there is no Caesar out there, really. We are Caesar. We have some form of representation in this government. So I think in our country, we very easily forget that there can often be conflicts between the demands of God and the demands of Caesar's. And so in our society, it means that there's a conflict within ourselves, and what we most often do is fail to see any conflict at all and go along thinking that we can serve God and Caesar or God and the United States government without any conflict. I think this story calls that into question. primary point being that at certain points, and I think that this is something that is said over and over again in both the Old and New Testament, that a Christian's commitment and allegiance to God may set them in opposition to the authorities in certain instances. And I believe it's valid for Christians to break laws that cause them to do something that's diametrically opposed to the gospel, or laws that prevent them from following the gospel. And it has been true throughout Christian history that there were situations where faithfulness might lead to civil disobedience. Both Old and New Testament are filled with illustrations of conscious violations of laws that prevented people from doing God's will. And if you want some help on this, there's a good tape in the tape library by Jerry Fulk, done a couple of years ago, on civil disobedience in the Bible. And he takes, I think, 20 or 25 different passages and has people break up into groups and look at them and talk about the implications of those passages. But it has been true throughout Christian history, especially in the early church. In more recent history, I think of 50 years ago when a group of 139 people from the churches in Germany who began to resist the Holocaust and the rule of Hitler and Nazism. Our Christians, brothers and sisters today who resist apartheid in South Africa. In our own country, we have a history of the Fugitive Slave Law Act. Now we applaud those who disobeyed that act. You know, we could go on and on, but the question is now one of those times where faithfulness to Christ might lead us in that direction towards civil disobedience? And that's really the question that I'm trying to get at, rather than make a statement saying that the Bible says we ought not to pay our taxes here or we ought to pay them here. Any response to that? You had your hand up, Jim.
Well, I'm struggling with some concepts here, but you know, one concept, you think that what I earn is mine, and therefore I have a right to withhold what I pay out. Well, you can get in a little structural problem, because what I'm able to earn in an organized society with a government and my ability to earn is dependent on all these relationships that are built up. So you really can't say that everything I earn is really mine. I wouldn't, if I was out in the woods all by myself, I probably wouldn't be able to earn those resources. So there's that relationship. Then we're a democracy. So when we talk about Caesar, that's really us. And so through the democratic process, we should be able to determine how much we put into the military or not put in. So, you know, that sense, in a democracy, we have the right to freedom of speech. We certainly have the right to protest and to try and influence as many people in the democratic process to change that, change where it goes. So that I can live with. Where I'm struggling is, I can't really say it's all mine, and, you know, I have, because our democratic process set up a structure, so it really isn't all mine. And that we talk, what's to Caesar goes to Caesar, what's to God goes to God. And what really, I don't know the answer, but I'm struggling with these concepts. And I guess the point I wanted to make is we have to keep a framework here that we are in a democracy, or not an emperor situation or a king situation, where the concept was the king owned it all and he doled it out in the feudal system. Mm-hmm. It's our government, and we can determine the structure. So the first thrust, of course, is to influence it as vigorously as possible through the democratic process. Now, once I agree to be under a democratic process, and then I agree to go by the will of the majority, I have every right to express myself, but once the majority has taken a position, then I have a problem of whether I have a right under that structure to then arbitrarily withhold once I've gone under the democratic process. I don't know the answer, but that's where my conflict
goes. So if I can just maybe capsulize and tell me if I'm being fair, that civil disobedience may be appropriate in Eastern Bloc country, for instance, but it would not be appropriate in a democracy if you have voted that person into office. And
if I had the right to exercise all the freedom of speech and persuasion and everything I can, then shouldn't I go with the will of the majority? That
civil disobedience would not be appropriate then in this country.
Well, civil disobedience, I guess, is what, to what extent is civil disobedience? I guess you said breaking the law.
Any response? I saw some other hands. So.
Well,
back there and then up here.
One of the tenets of the biggest civil disobeyers of the legitimate, sorry, you know, the kings and so on, has been that they accept that they will accept consequences, legal consequences, going to jail or whatever, too, which makes it just more serious.
You mean if you best disobey?
I mean, it's not a question of whether or not you have a right to do it. It's a question that you are, in fact, disobeying the law, and you accept that you will probably be punished, but that you accept that.
So you have the right to make that statement.
I guess so.
Well, I think that we could make a much stronger statement. You speak about helping the poor, the needy, and so on. I mean, even with our own tax system, if we would take that 20% off the top and give it to the churches, which probably are more effective in handling it than anything else, we would be both reducing the amount we're paying in taxes and probably being much more effective in what we want to do with these people that need it without this, without the war pester. I mean, I'm against war. I mean, I think everybody is. But I think we aren't using the avenues we could use much more effectively. If all the church people would give 20% of their income, or I mean the Christians, to doing something, what a statement that would make. And don't you think that would make a statement for a reduction of armaments?
What do we give now? Is it 2% for Lutherans?
Yeah, about 2%. 1.5%.
I mean, I think we got our things mixed up. I mean, we have the resources, we just don't use it effectively.
I wouldn't argue with that. I think we could all double and triple what we give, but that wouldn't help change the law if our main reason for objecting is that we feel that our congressmen aren't voting the way we want them to vote. I feel like maybe I can change the law by doing it, but I know I can't do it by not. I can't change the law by not objecting, resisting.
You get the message? If the church should start to give that kind of money,
civil rights laws never would have been changed if people hadn't resisted and broken the law.
There is some sort of precedent here for. I mean, if you go back to throwing tea into the Boston Harbor,
but that was not democracy. That was without representation.
Well, Martin Luther King, lots of child labor laws. The
women's
union
suffrage.
Movement, women's suffrage.
The Vietnamese War never would have ended without the resistance that finally...
There are some examples in this country where civil disobedience has led to change. So, I mean, that's speaking of it strictly in terms of effectiveness now. But I'm not sure that that's my point here. My point would be that as Christians, we are first and foremost not about resisting the United States government or the IRS or breaking laws, but perhaps at times the only way, and I'm speaking for myself, the only way to say yes to the gospel is to resist something that I believe to be very evil. And that resistance is a response to my call to be a peacemaker. And I think that's why more and more people are choosing this form of resistance, not because it necessarily will by itself turn around the arms race, but that people feel that because that as they are paying now more and more money for the arms race through their taxes, that is disobeying Jesus' call to love our enemies, to do good to those who hate us, to bless those who persecute us. So there are people who cannot any longer in good conscience continue to pay. So I guess that, Jim, is the place where the Christian conscience comes in not being allowed anymore to follow a law that they feel to be evil, even though the majority of the country might have agreed to that law. I think there are places where Christians may draw lines and say, I can't do this because of my faith any longer, and I will accept the consequences for that. I didn't get you again, so
I really think that some of the things that Dan Erlander was saying in his Bible studies over the last 3 weeks or 3 days about the Christian church being a bubble in a world has an application here. I really think that one of the things that we're called to do is to be a witness to the world around us, and the fact that I live in a democratic country and have some as much participation as I can in the democratic process doesn't mean that my country is one country under God, as we teach our children so carefully to say, that there still is a lot of witnessing to be done, and there still is a lot of ways that we can work to change laws that we feel are not representing what we want.
Let me read just, well, Chuck, why don't you share? I don't know if you were going to talk
well,
about
I was just going to draw the parallel with selective participation or objection to war, which you alluded to when there's a draft. I think the clearest Lutheran statement, which really goes back to Luther, of civil disobedience being legitimate for the Christian, is the question of when your prince orders you to war in a conflict you believe is unjust. Luther very clearly says repeatedly in many of his essays on the subject of obeying civil authority that you must say no because it is not right to go against conscience. And Lutheran bodies in this country have picked that up. All the major bodies, including Missouri, LCA, ALC, in the Vietnam years, reaffirmed that position. That is the official position. You don't have to agree with it. You can dissent from it, but that's the officially stated position of Lutheran bodies in the U.S. That you must, if you believe in conscience that this particular military action is improper, illegitimate, unjust for you, you must say no, and you must be willing to go to jail for that, or leave the country, or whatever you choose to do. That's very clearly stated. So to that extent, Lutherans have for a long time supported civil disobedience. It's always said you must take the penalty. You must respect the law by taking the burden of what the law requires of you in order to keep faith with your own conscience. I think where this issue, Tom, gets a little hazier for a lot of Lutherans, a lot of people, is not all Lutherans would agree that spending for military purposes is for purposes of making war or even preparing for war. Some would argue it's for purposes of keeping the peace. And we divide on that as Lutherans, and I think as Americans. Or what part of our military spending is for peace purposes and what part is for making war? Mm-hmm. You know, we divide on that. But very few, I think, in the Lutheran Church would say that all of my tax dollars that go for military purposes is for making war.
Mm-hmm. Tax resistors generally would take that precedent of conscientious objection and say, we want that expanded now. Because not only can I not kill, but I cannot pay other people to prepare for that. And at least part of this budget, and we can argue about the different statistics, but at least part of this budget is preparing to do that.
And it's disproportionate on the side of too much overkill.
Yeah, and it's generally, if I read most tax resistors, right, and I can speak for myself, it's an opposition to a system that has gone out of control. I'm not sure that it is opposition to certain weapon systems, but it's a general opposition to a military system that has really become idolatrous and has gone out of control, and that, as a Christian, I need to be saying no to that. One back here.
Or anyone that reads some of the General Accounting Office reports on waste and government in general and military expenditures in particular, I think becomes a close to an objector just on that basis alone.
Yes. Yeah. But I thought all the fraud and waste was in the welfare system. Now you're saying it's in the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading. Well, Casper Weinberger said that there is no more waste in the officials about a year ago. I don't think William Proxmire would have read it.
Let me read just a couple paragraphs of some of this part about, and this is written by John Howard Yoder, entitled Why I Don't Pay All of My Income Tax. And it might answer a couple questions still out there. One question remains, which both the Internal Revenue Service Inspector and other Christians have already asked. Does not the New Testament instruct us to pay our taxes? Certainly it does, and I want to pay my taxes and do pay them willingly as far as the functions of the United States government resemble what Jesus and Paul and Peter were talking about. The lesson of the entire New Testament is that Christians should be subject to political authority because in the providence of God, the function of these authorities is to maintain peace. This is what I, in accordance with the instructions of the New Testament, am asking the American government to do. I am, in fact, even willing to pay for a certain amount of waste and fraud and incompetence. But the one thing I'm not prepared to support voluntarily is something which Jesus and Paul did not have in mind because it did not exist in the time of the New Testament. The government of Rome was not spending more than half of its resources on preparations to destroy the rest of the world. The authority which Jesus and Paul recognized was in that entire age much more comparable to the police function than to the modern economy for international war. It is not often noticed that Romans 13 provides textual grounds for questioning any government on the propriety of the requirements it makes of its citizens. Romans 13:7 says specifically, not that we are to render to governments what it asks for, but that we are to give each to what is due, to each what is due, tax to whom tax is due, toll to whom toll, worship to whom worship. There is no easy discharge from the duty to test which of the demands of Caesar's are really the things that are Caesar's and which are not his due. It is not my purpose to agitate for others to follow my example. At the same time, I'm asking whether others have found more appropriate ways to render a worthwhile testimony against their nation's trust in the sword. I don't want to come off as saying that if one is to be a responsible Christian, one should do tax resistance, but that's not my point at all. What I am saying is that I think the payment of taxes should be a faith issue for us, that every April 15th when we sign that line, we ought to be thinking about what we're doing, because I think that if we're concerned about war, we ought to be concerned about the taxes that we're paying. Let me just quickly run through the rest of my presentation, and I hope we have some time left at the end. I'll just run through some different ways that people have chosen to be tax resisters and then conclude with a little summary. Many of the ways one becomes a tax resister are illegal, but there are some legal forms, starting from writing your congressperson about your views on how much we're spending for the military. There is, by the way, a bill in Congress, it's been there every year since 1972, called the World Peace Tax Fund Bill, which, if approved, would make tax resistance a legal option. The way that would happen is that there would probably be a box on your tax form similar to, there's some other boxes that you can check now on your tax form whether you want to give money to a certain fund. It would allow a tax resister or a pacifist to check the box and say, I don't want any of my money going to military purposes. What would happen is you would not pay any less tax. You would pay the same amount, but your money then would do sort of alternative service like a conscientious objector would. Your money would be channeled then into a special fund that would be only used for life-preserving and peace-promoting purposes.
Wouldn't that just divert other people's taxes a larger percentage into military?
Sure, which is exactly what, you know, it's the same with conscientious objection. I mean, if I refuse to go to war, it doesn't mean that there isn't a war. It just means that somebody else has to go in my place. But the one thing that it does do is that it creates a new fund for peace that was never there before. And they have some statistics. If 4% of the people in this country check the box, it would be how many million dollars going for peace that was never there before. So it's not a save-all solution, but at least it's a start, I think, in the right direction. It would make people ask that question each time they filled out the form, do I want to pay for this? Or am I conscientiously, you know, opposed to that?
Related to that, could I just ask, because I just was afraid it wouldn't come up at all, is any money being appropriated, or thought of being appropriated for a peace academy? I understand there is a bill in
the bill of Congress and that they're having some tough times with it, and I don't know, I haven't heard within the last month how it's doing. If anyone else has other information, it has not been passed yet. So we have.
Yeah, that's one of the proposed recipients of a peace tax fund diversion. Things like that would benefit. The bill itself is not going anywhere. Tom's correct. It's still, it has a lot of support in Congress, a lot of co-signers. Mark Hatfield of Oregon is the prime Senate sponsor, has been for years. Ronald Reagan has said he will not sign it if it's passed. So my guess is it won't come out of Congress until after this administration, next year or 5 years from now, whenever that may be. But I think eventually it'll be passed because there's a growing public support for the idea of an academy which at the graduate school level does research and training in nonviolent resolution of conflict alongside the three military academies. And the concept's been around since George Washington advanced it back in 200 years ago. So I think eventually it'll become part of our structure of dealing with international conflicts.
Let me just quickly finish the options here. You could write to your congressperson about that, will this tax bill in support of it. Some people don't actually withhold money from their taxes, but send in their form along with a letter of protest. And I would encourage anyone who feels strongly about it, who's not willing to, at this point, commit civil disobedience, that you do that. It's perfectly legal. Send in a letter of protest to the IRS with your form. Also copies to your congresspeople, to your church leaders, to your family members. I think that's very helpful.
Tom, does that, cause the IRS then to probably pick on your insurance?
It might. I wouldn't rule out that possibility, but I would add, if you want it to, I think this is what Carol's going to say, if you want it to be noticed, staple it to your form. Otherwise, it will be discovered. Also, another legal form of tax resistance is to choose to live under a taxable income so that you're not paying taxes. Now, if you were work at Holland Village, like I did for 2 years, that's not very hard to do. I did that for several years, and I was not paying war taxes. Some other methods that are legal. First of all, one can withhold one's telephone tax. If you're not aware, the telephone tax has been levied as a war tax for a long time. Was a lot higher than it was at one point during World War II and during the Vietnam War, up to about 10%. But many people opposed this tax and just refused to pay it. They paid their entire phone bill but withheld the tax. And that's something that's very easy to do every month. The phone company cooperates. They do not shut off your service. In fact, if you forget to send in your note, sometimes they remind you. They simply take that off your bill automatically after a while. It's not a lot of money, but it's a very clear symbol that you do not want this tax that is being levied for war, and you don't want to pay for that any longer.
The government can eventually collect it, however.
Sure, and it has been true in some cases, but it is a very low-risk form of tax resistance. There has been no one prosecuted. The government has come and gotten your money back.
Out of your bank account.
Yeah, but there has been no one jailed for that. Another option is to simply withhold all or a percentage of your federal income tax and then rechannel that money that you withhold into other funds, to peaceful purposes, into escrow accounts or whatever. And people take different percentages. Some people withhold all of their taxes. Some people withhold 63%, 43%, 10%, any kind of symbolic figure.
Tom, there's one other you didn't mention. The more we give away in to church and charity, the less we will pay.
That would be along with living under taxable income, simply increasing your charitable contributions so that you don't have to pay so much taxes anymore. That's another way to legally be a tax resistor. I'm not going to go into a lot of the specifics about how to do all these things, because I firmly believe that that's the last thing you would want to know. I think it's much more important for people to know the why of tax resistance rather than the how-to. There's lots of good resources out about the how-to. And so I'm going to move on now and just do a couple of summarizing statements about what I think tax resistance is and isn't as a symbol for today. And if you can, the bell rings, please bear with me because I'm almost done. And I'd like to finish this. First of all, what tax resistance is not as a symbol. First, it's not unambiguous, or in other words, it is ambiguous. One of the disadvantages of this form of protest is that sometimes confusing, because the taxes that you are withholding in income tax withholding, they're not only war taxes. Our money is split between military and non-military purposes, so right now the taxpayer has no way of resisting one or the other, meaning that if you're sort of in a bind. If you decide to withhold all of your taxes, then you're not paying for the good things the taxes go for. In other words, health, research, aid, education, support for the poor. But if you decide to withhold only a portion of your tax, then the portion that you do pay goes into a general fund, most of which goes to the military. So it's very hard to act with any consistency when you still end up paying for military unless you withdraw your entire support. Another related clarification: tax resistance is not, and in my opinion, cannot be a stand of moral purity. As you know, it's not an effort to wash your hands of the arms race, as if now that I've stopped paying taxes, I'm no longer connected. And there's lots of ways that we're all connected with the arms race. Buying gas at a gas station that pays money to a corporation that invests in or that might be involved in unjust practices or investing in defense industries. I mean, there are ways that we are connected and always will be. Another main consideration about tax resistance is that it may or may not seem to be an effective protest. And that depends, of course, on your definition of what effectiveness is. But it's true that in many cases, not in all cases, that the government often gets the money back with interest and sometimes penalties added. Some people are disappointed that they don't even have that direct confrontation with the IRS. You simply get form letters from them, and then one day your money's gone from your bank account. That's frustrating. While the government cannot keep up with the increasing number of war tax resistors, I think that it's ironic sometimes that tax resistors sometimes end up paying more money to the government than someone who's not resisting taxes. And certainly, as someone said, Peter, I think that tax resistance does not keep money from the defense departments. Even if you don't pay, that means someone else is paying a higher percentage. So those are, I think, some maybe drawbacks of this symbol, but please bear with me for the positive points. We're close to the bell. I think tax resistance is and can be a very clear and appropriate symbol of protest, and that's exactly what it is. It's a symbol. It's a call for civil disobedience precisely at that point where preparation for war most directly intersects our lives, and that's at the payment of taxes every April 15th. I cannot think of a closer connection. A.G. Musty once said, the only difference between going to war and paying for it is that one is more convenient. In fact, to pay for it without being willing to do it lacks some integrity. I hear many people at home and say, there's nothing I can do, but you know, I think it's because we have not confronted yet our personal connection through taxes. I'll use an analogy that Lowell Erdahl often uses, ALC Bishop. If there's a fire burning and you don't want it to burn, well, stop throwing wood on it. Or if the beast is knocking at the door, stop feeding it. Or if you don't want the plant to grow, stop watering it. Well, my gosh, if we don't want war, let's stop paying for it. It's very simplistic, maybe, but I think that it has a lot of merit. Tax resistance is one avenue of protest among many. It's not the only way to resist the arms race, but I think it's one very concrete act of personal witness that gives credibility to what we say we're about anyway. I don't think we can have a budget exactly the way we want it, and if we have to compromise, that's essential, but I don't think that lets us off the hook. It's all a compromise, and we still have an obligation to bring our actions in line with what we say we're about. And if it's not a stand of moral purity, at least, it's the lesser of two evils right now to resist paying taxes than to pay them. The last point has to do with whether or not it's effective. It may be effective. I think it is effective, but for more importantly, I think it's a faithful thing to do. I have decided that I have to refuse because my conscience will no longer allow me to willingly help finance war, nuclear war especially, something that we believe to be evil. And I think the word willing is very important here. It has to do with paying voluntarily. I may not be able in my efforts to keep the government from using my money to build bombs, but at least I can remove my voluntary consent. At least I will not just give it to them, I will make them come and take it from me. And that is what I wish more and more Christians and Lutherans would have done 50 years ago in Nazi Germany. I wish they would have laid down on the tracks in front of those trains going to Auschwitz. An SS man can pick you up and throw you off the tracks, but at least you didn't leave the issue uncontested. And I feel like if I continue paying taxes right now, I'm leaving that issue uncontested. So I simply have to resist. There are many people that feel it's not worth the effort. The IRS doesn't see the protest. But I think even if they don't formally recognize it, your protest is seen by family and friends, by congresspeople, by church leaders. People know you feel strongly about it. There's nothing in my mind that raised the nuclear issue in this part of the country like Archbishop Hunhausen with his protest, John Nelson with his protest at Trident. I think that it's a very clear symbol. And if even if it makes some people uncomfortable, I think that if there's healthy debate in the church about an uncomfortable issue, that's a hopeful sign. So Thanks for coming. I'll be around.